Well, it's a real pleasure to be here. Good afternoon. And I really want to extend my thanks and gratitude to Sharika. I think Dr. Sanchez pointed out she's extremely, extremely humble about her role in moving these issues forward locally, nationally, and internationally. Thank you, Sharika, for your leadership. I also see some members of our committee, Larry Green, who really is just a strong mentoring and leadership voice for public health on many levels, and really pleasure to have work with so many fine people on the committee. I think what I want to do is just give you some of the reaction and usefulness of this. It was an interesting experience to be on the committee as a state health official in a new role. Prior to that, primary care physician, I ran a medical center, community health center, was a local health official in Austin, city of Austin, as the health director, medical director, and a local health authority there, and then moving on to the state. So I've seen kind of public health, primary care, community primary care, etc. And so seeing how these recommendations really influence, I'm really pleased to see, again, like Dr. Sanchez and his early committee report, where you really can see some very practical, useful outcomes of this, what may appear to be scholarly work at times, but really has practical implications. I have, unfortunately, no financial disclosures to disclose. I wish I did, but I don't. I'm a public health official in Texas. I want to just review some of the study charge, which Sharika said, and it was, again, to describe that current nature of the evidence base. So I think Sharika did a wonderful thing of outlining that. But also, this is for maybe more for us in public health practice, identifying those challenges associated with integrating that scientific evidence with broader influences on policy and programmatic consideration. So again, how do I pull in the science, whether it's the biology or the public health science, into the policy? And that's always been a challenge and continues to be, and I know we struggle with that. Again, providing a practical framework for how to select, implement, and evaluate that. And so she showed you the LEAD and walked you through that LEAD framework, and I'll just touch base on that quickly. And then again, new tools and methods can be used to build useful and timely evidence base. And so within the report, there are appendices which have and share some of those. And I'll touch on that as well and their utility. And then, of course, developing a plan for communicating, disseminating, evaluating, and refining this. And hopefully we will exceed supersede the timeline that typically we see information from clinical research coming into clinical practice in public health. I know we're fast learners and early adopters, so hopefully that's true. When we pull in clinical research into the bedside or the practice, it takes about 17 years for someone to finally say, well, we learned that. So almost a generation. I'm challenging us to move faster than that. Please, because we've got a big problem on our hand. How many of you have seen this slide today, or ever? I know Larry said he didn't want to show the spaghetti slide, but I'm showing it because that's my challenge. That's our challenge. It's a very complex system. What we're saying is that, and we know, obesity is not a biologic process caused by a singular agent that has a singular mechanism for addressing that illness. It's not an infectious disease that I can give an antibiotic to. It's not an acute thrombosis that if I put thrombolytics or a cardiac cath in it, I fix the problem in a clean clinical setting in a known population that works in anyone who I do that in, by the way. It's much more complex to that. But this is also our challenge in understanding that complexity. And I think part of what the report is saying is that systems thinking is a must. We have to understand that obesity is complex biologically, complex sociologically, economically, complex politically. And it changes over time. It's dynamic. All of these problems change. So that blood clot, it really doesn't change. It hasn't changed in 40 years. We don't have something else making a new blood clot that leads to an acute MI. But obesity, these really tough public health issues are complex, and they change over time and can change. And by the way, the report's not just about obesity. What we're saying is this framework will work for any complex public health issue. Now, I throw that up there again because the challenge is, as my boss, the Commissioner of Health, once told me when I said, try to draw these out and use these type of models to say, hey, in infant mortality, it's like this. And he looks at it and he says, yeah, but that won't sell downtown. So our challenge is, I can't sit in front of an elected official and say, well, this is it, and if we do these 2,500 things, it's not going to sell, and we know that. And so our challenge is to maybe move from this very complex system, we know it, And our challenge is to then maybe move to a little simpler model. And I agree with Dr. Sun. This, by the way, I think, is a much simpler model, again, from the 2005 Institute of Medicine report, Energy in the Balance, and talks about that, preventing childhood obesity. It's much cleaner. I think we see it. It's a little easier for me to explain. This is still too complex for a lot of folks, as you know, trying to tell them that we need multi-level interventions in multi-sectors all the time. And I need this many resources to do that. It's very hard to do for individuals, you know, when they want to just measure, you know, data and say, and send a report card home, you know, of your BMI, and then that will miraculously change our childhood obesity efforts. So we know it's more complex, but this is still not simple enough sometimes. And in fact, you know, in our challenge, I think, on the public health practice side, for example, is in at the state level, we have to move all of that complex systems and science and policies into some very discrete plans that I can tell someone this is what we're trying to do in our state, you know, and these are very simple goals, you know, but people understand that I need to be able to measure where I am and where I'm going. I need to be able to tell people about it, raise awareness, tell them how to prevent it. You know, it's like risk communication 101. It's tell me what you know, what I don't know, and let me tell you what you can do to protect yourself. I'm going to tell you what we're doing to protect you. So we work through that. We can talk about mobilizing communities and partners, and that's always critical, you know, and promoting these policies. Now, I know all of us in the room are very challenged with trying to move, again, from I think it's that randomized controlled trial kind of permeates through public health practice in a negative specter, in that's what everyone wants to find, that golden bullet, right? The pill that will make this better, when you know it's more complex. And so when you start talking about environmental change or policy change, that gets translated to me from elected officials, why are you buying stuff? You know, why are you buying playground equipment? Why are you working in that community to label menus? You know, people can make their own choice about what they eat. Anyway, I think we've all experienced some issues, so that challenge of translating the science of public health into that, and that framework might help you do this. But I'm just showing this as an example of how we have to try to simplify from the very complex to a very simple way of communicating what we're trying to do, and then have the evidence behind that to support that. So again, we synthesize the evidence for action, and I think Shariki mentioned this, but we're really trying to say, I think Bill Purcell on the committee as a former mayor was very good about saying, you know, what do constituents want? They want to know, one, is this a problem? You know, why is this a problem? And then what should we do about it? And that's where they're going to turn to you or me and say, well, what should we do about it, Dr. Valdez, or someone out here in the room? And we need to know where to go and say, well, here's what I know. We'll talk about that. They're going to want to know who we should do this to or whom, you know, is this intervention for, and how do we do it? What's the best way? What's the most effective way? Cost effective. I'm going to tell you right now, in our state that has a $25 billion budget deficit, we're asking a lot about the last one and what's it going to cost. And so we know these are very practical questions that you face all the time, but we wanted to, as part of the framework, assure that we ask those, that we can't just talk about a study design and that internal validity, and yes, it absolutely is solid and we can tell the, you know, plausibility and association with it, but as Shariki pointed out, but this doesn't apply to our community because it's not like us and we don't live like that and we don't have the other contextual factors that really determine the outcome more than that one pathway. So these are really important things. Now here's an example, and Larry Green, I shared this with me, and I think it's a great example of tobacco control efforts. This is not a randomized controlled trial. Okay, we didn't wait for this to occur, and people saw this evidence with back for several decades between 84, 98, and into the late 90s, where we saw no change in 48 states in terms of cigarette consumption. And then in about the late 90s, early to late 90s, we saw some movement in California where they began to impose an excise tax on cigarette consumption. And you started to see that, well, my God, it had an effect. And people took notice and said, well, that's interesting. California, tell us what you're doing. People talk to California, they learn, it was best practice. So this is kind of your best example of practice-based evidence, right, that we learned about this. And then Massachusetts took it a step further, and I was there during that time as a primary care provider and really saw how you could take from the lessons of California and apply that multi-level, multi-layer intervention that got you this tremendous reduction in cigarette consumption and increased quit rates, et cetera. So very positive outcomes. Again, this was not in a journal as a randomized controlled trial, and I think what we're trying to say is that there's other evidence out there. And in the report, we're really saying give permission to look at that other evidence. Be transdisciplinary. Look across sectors. Education has been doing evaluation work for years and years on this. Sociologists have been doing a lot of work in complex systems and people's behavior. How more complex can that be? Economics, very valuable. So we're really saying that there are other places to look for the evidence than in your medical or clinical journal that shows a randomized controlled trial. Again, I think Shariki pointed this out, and I'm going to just move through that because she already talked through it, but just kind of what's in the book that kind of explains that. I found it very helpful already because of the thing I've learned by expanding my horizons. What I found is that a lot of folks, and I think if you have conversations with individuals, you read through the book and the appendices in particular, is that we all get very comfortable with what we know. And even when I talk to some of my senior scientists or think and say, hey, what about this? Or have you ever done, you know, look at propensity score modeling for quasi-experimental design? You know, suddenly they say, well, I wasn't familiar with that. I didn't know. And I say, oh, well, you know, I was introduced, you know, here's a statistical method to create a control group that's very effective and almost gives you results as good as a randomized controlled trial. You know, there's all these other methods out there that, and for example, that people don't know. We haven't really explored that. And really what we're saying is it's permission to go look around and see what methods are out there and maybe use them, try them, see if they're helpful in your study. And so that's the one thing I found that I'm seeing every day when I talk to some of our public health practitioners, our epidemiologists, our statisticians. I've had a lot of good feedback in just introducing some new ideas and pointing them in this direction. And suddenly people go, oh, that's interesting. And then they send me three more articles, which I can never interpret because they're from statistical journals, but about, oh, well, did you see this? And what about that? But it just enough to open that dialogue about maybe we should look somewhere else. Again, Shariki mentioned this, and I think it's important, though, because to reemphasize, because we really were saying and looking, and I hope for different disciplines in the room, not just the public health practitioners, that we really are trying to say we've got to all incorporate that systems-based thinking. We have to look transdisciplinary. We need to look at then what leads to that or what can move us in that direction. So certainly funding differently, looking at more transdisciplinary research funding opportunities instead of our typical categorical funding streams. Certainly training differently. Again, how many folks here ever took systems dynamic courses or modeling courses or even a systems thinking course in their public health? We really have to begin to just acknowledge that the world that we practice in is complex and difficult, but it's not unpredictable. And some of those models and those techniques help us to have a better sense of how we can approach these very complex problems. Again, training differently and publishing differently. I think one of the issues we find is what you don't find in the literature, which is often reports that lay out perhaps why the study was in effect, or looking more at that external validity issue of generalizability and giving you the information we really need to make it generalizable. You know, well, how many folks were in that control group? How many, you know, what was the attrition rate? How did they select them? How did they, you know, there's a lot of data information that helps on the generalizability side, reach, impact, et cetera, that aren't often reported in studies. And so you don't know, is this applicable in my community? So we're asking for folks to think about that differently. You saw the LEAD framework again, and it outlines that. Within the book, there's also some methods to help compile, present the evidence so that you can have it in a concise way. It really begins with asking specific questions and laying it out. I find that it is very helpful because oftentimes, what many of you have seen, I know I've seen it many times, is that the staffers for elected officials, decision makers, and policy makers, they don't know anything about public health. They're new, they're learning, and they have best intentions. They want to help. And so helping to be able to provide concise information through a more methodologic process, but yet attainable and accessible. You don't have to be a public health scientist and epidemiologist to do this. Anyone can do this. They might need you, the public health scientist or professional, to help explain that, and that's your role, and I think your appropriate role, where you can work with that individual to teach him about that method or this method or what the science is behind that. But they can begin to, in a transparent process, get the data. Oftentimes, you know, I'm challenged in fact, I was having this conversation with my commissioner the other day, abstinence education and how we should do evaluation. Well, let me tell you, on one hand, if you do evaluation internally, people are going to say, well, you did that because you're just supporting your administration and you wanted to get that answer. If I do it externally, I'll get criticized because, if it finds no difference, you're just doing that because you just don't like abstinence and you just want to shoot it down. You know, we can't win. But there's some time where in that scenario, you've got to be able to provide a transparent framework to say, here's the evidence, here's the evaluation, here's how we came to that conclusion. So just an example of how this could be useful in applying it, where it shows that I have no agenda. I'm just showing you what evidence there has been. My evaluation of that evidence, it could be their staffer's evaluation of that evidence, and how we come to a conclusion about it. So again, we talked about some of that. I think it's important to point out, because this is true even when I first got on the committee, you know, I struggled with this for a while about, well, is this going to give me the answer that Shariki said, oh, great, now I know where to go find the evidence, and as I think, I like how Shariki put it, you know, A plus B and then stir, and then I get, suddenly obesity's gone in my community, it's great. If I can implement it, it's not that, this is not, so if you're looking for a solution, you're not going to find it, okay? I'm just going to tell you, it is not a decision tree to say, do the X, Y, and Z and get this, because we're acknowledging the complexity and the uniqueness of everyone's community, the context, the real world life which we have to operate and implement these programs, and that's the point. But the science, the biologic plausibility, those pieces can still apply, but then you've got to incorporate that community wisdom, that public health practice that you've generated into your decision making. So these are the contributions. I think we feel that it expands the toolkit, it grants permission to look for elsewhere for evidence and to view other types of evidence as having value. In other words, we're not going to write off just because it's in an education journal that technique or that methodology wasn't useful. It actually could be very useful. It requires, a broader focus on the systems issues and understanding them. A process that you can utilize to work through the evidence, find the evidence, assemble it, evaluate it, and then use it for decision making, and hopefully changes how evidence is viewed, and thus how we might change public policy around public health decisions. For this, you know, for health officials or public health practitioners, I'll just put this out there because I'm at the end of time here, but really using it as a guide in the use and generation of evidence. I think the other piece that Shariki briefly mentioned, but oftentimes I think we're going to walk through this and you're going to say, you know, we looked at all the evidence that we found and we have a big gap still. Well, that's your research agenda. That lays out the questions you need to ask and start working with your partners, again, your academic partners or others, and reach out across disciplines to start laying out those questions. Say, you know what, I really need this question answered. It would help me most in my community. And that's part of that strength here. It certainly summarizes the conclusions of evidence synthesis. And then that last bullet is, again, leading back to those public and private consortiums where we can begin to discuss the use of the framework. Is it useful? Evaluate itself and look at how we can continue to utilize this methodology to improve public health outcomes. So really, what I found overall is that and I'm just going to put that, I think we all know this, it's obesity, it's a multi-component, multi-level strategy, see there I go using my language, which impacts whole communities and complex systems, basically. We know that the evidence needed for designing and selecting and assessing intervention and strategies is different than most of the evidence that has been previously collected. So we understand that there may be a gap there. I think it's important that third bullet, which we've been saying, and which I think the local government's actions book basically said, is we can implement these things on the best available evidence. We do not have to wait for the best possible evidence. We'll be waiting longer than 17 years to implement that. And hopefully that we'll have a richer, more relevant, useful evidence base, which will then inform us and improve decision-making in the long run. But it's not going to, you know, free us from making judgment. Again, it's not going to mean that I'm going to be able to go A plus B equals C, we're done. I've got to sit there and within my community, within the context, social, political, economic, factor all that in and the science and the evidence and come to a decision. I'm still going to have to exercise judgment. We all do that every day. But we feel that this framework will help you better do that and come to better decisions. So I thank you for your time and happy to answer any questions.
I want to identify Dr. James Krieger, who is in the back of the room. He was a part of the Local Government Actions Committee, and he and Laura Brennan worked on us trying to reconcile this issue of the evidence base and the challenges associated with it that this committee took on with our task to put out a report that was based on evidence. And just wanted to recognize you.
So I think our time is up. Mine is about 2 minutes. Are there any questions or clarifications or comments?
I just want to thank you guys for what you've been doing, because I think that you really have an amazing Institute of Medicine point that a lot of us who are doing practice can start to eat and breathe and chew on, and use this stuff. So congratulations to you all. One of the challenges that I run up against, and I wonder if you guys considered this in your, is what evidence is being collected at the state level? The degree to which we have good surveillance data in our state
I think we mentioned it in the justification of why the importance of surveillance and monitoring, but it doesn't go much farther than that. That's the basis. Somebody could take that and take it farther, but we didn't go into it in much detail. I don't know if
the
local governments do.
I think the work was done by the second committee that that was looking at the progress that's been made to address childhood obesity absolutely made a recommendation about improvements in monitoring and surveillance.
Right.
And I think all of us in here would agree with you that we need more granularity in order to know whether what we're doing is making a difference.
Yeah, but maybe that's another report specifically on that issue, right? Did I see another? Yeah, okay. That'd be the last question, right? Yeah.
Building off that comment, the slide that Dr. Dallas showed that a cigarette consumption drop in California, Massachusetts, if we had something like that, right, for obesity, you know, one being very simple, one could try and reverse engineer where communities are showing are doing something, right? Some mix of environmental factors.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that some people get upset with the tobacco analogy because by comparison, it seems simple when you look at the number of behaviors that go into changing eating and physical activity. So I don't know that we'll ever find one lever that will make a big change like that, but a combination will if people can document combinations of things that have been tried, you know, in a neighborhood like New York City where there's multiple things going on. If you can show that a set of four policies together with some social marketing would move the needle, then I think in another community it might not be those same four policies, but the idea is that if you do logical things and you put them together and then enhance them with social marketing and direct consumer advocacy, that maybe you can get something done. So, I mean, Vito showed you the foresight diagram from the United Kingdom. For those of you who don't know it, it is the total map of causes of obesity. And so working even within one sector, we do have to put some things together that enable or act directly, on the problem. But we'll keep trying. We need the documentation anyway, but I guess I'm cautious because we try to make the point that when you do two things and you feel great about them and you want to rush off and show your decision maker how that's going to affect obesity and you don't see the BMI change, you might have done yourself a disservice because that may be only part of the mix, the necessary but not sufficient. So we have to think it through. Could that have moved the needle at the same time as we try to evaluate? So I won't keep you any longer. Thanks so much for your attention and enthusiasm.